sign. So Ingrid, do you want to start out at this one?
Okay.
What's that?
Oh, yeah.
No, I have no problems.
I don't have any.
I thought you were taking, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. You're not a reader?
No.
Okay.
I just thought you were taking, so who was here?
I have a tendency.
Those are some red, huh?
But now you're going to create.
That's about it.
Okay, so what's the format? We just share a couple of poems or whatever, or?
You bet.
Okay.
Go for it.
All right. Well, I don't have too much of my poetry committed to memory, but I'll start with my two favorite ones, which I do have, hopefully, committed to memory. The first one is called The Yellow Tractor. I gave away his clothes and shoes and sold some tools and auto parts and other things he had in life that now just cluttered up the yard. And it is strange to see them go in other hands to other tasks. These things no longer needed now. But is it painful, someone asks, to part with all your husband's things, to see all his possessions gone? Yeah, it is sad, I must admit, but life demands that it be done. And I have sweet remembering I do not need what once was his. Objects are objects, after all. It is the man himself I miss. And so the tractor, too, must go, no longer needed, its driver gone. A young man eyes it greedily, and before long the deal is done. But as I watch it drive away, I feel as if my heart will break, and I cannot control my tears, nor throw from me this searing ache at yellow tractor. Suddenly, a flood of memories comes back. I see him tinkering beneath the hood. I see him working on the track, and like a king upon his throne, commanding pedals, clutches, blade, he carves the road, the path, the space that now contains the home we made. It is a living, breathing thing, this yellow tractor, like a steed that carries forth the toiling night so he may do his noble deed. I see him still, and I must turn and hide my eyes and walk away. My night retreats, his battle done. The yellow tractor had its day. And another one that I really like, which I hope I will remember intact, it's called The Seasons of Love. The breathless passion of our youth, desire to cause the heart to race, the soul to fly on angel's wings on seeing the beloved's face, the fierce embrace, the hungry kiss, like crashing waves upon a reef, that augured melding of ourselves in ecstasies beyond belief. Oh, such was the infancy of love, the urgent pangs when love was new. But from that tempest at the start, a calmer, deeper ocean grew, a caring, tender, steadfast union that soothed the daily cares each night, a fecund bonding that brought forth abundant life and sweet delight. And love grew deeper and secure and steadfast with each procreation, amassing riches of the soul and viewing life with approbation. And though the ocean roiled at times as life caused fickle winds to blow, the depths of love are yet unchanged, untouched by surface ebb and flow. And as to glass the sea returns, becalmed and gentle on its face, so love in sweet contentment bides and lives in comfort and in grace. And passion of a deeper kind, one that transcends the bonds of earth and sates the soul to overflowing, now gives full measure of its worth. And love is peace, and peace is knowing, whether together or apart, the door of death cannot divide us. You are forever in my heart. I'll share one more with you and then I'll give it to somebody else. if I can find it. I have four remarkable grandchildren, of course. And my grandson, my youngest grandson, Calvin, when he was 3 years old, sat down and he had the most amazing conversations for a tot that young. And he was telling me about what he remembered of his life up to that point. So I wrote this for Calvin, who told me he remembers when he was none. I thought that was an incredible concept for a three-year-old to have. And who, by his own reckoning, this July of 2008 is aged 3 3/2 because I'm older than 3 3/4. He knew that half was more than a quarter. So this is entitled, When I Was None. When I was 3, I climbed a tree and rode my scooter on the street and scooted all the way downstairs on nothing but my cedar. I went to school and learned a lot, like reading books to mom and dad, and I no longer take a nap, and all my toys are neater. When I was 2, I saw the zoo. 'Twas all lit up with Christmas lights. My favorite toy was Nathan's truck, and mac and cheese were yummy. I built a snowman in the yard, played on the beach at summertime. I took a nap most afternoons and cuddled lots with mommy. When I was 1, I tried to run and fell and bumped my knees and chin and screamed because I was really mad. But mom made me feel better. I tried to reach things on the shelves. Mom wouldn't let me climb the stairs. Gracie would swish her tail at me and I would try to get her. When I was none, I couldn't run or walk or hardly stand at all. I tried to scoot along or roll from back onto my belly. I cried a lot and slept a lot and played with soft and cuddly toys. I wore a diaper all the time and sometimes they were smelly. When I was none, I did have fun by holding on to Daddy's hands. He pulled me up so I could stand. Together we would walk. I loved to listen to him read and look at pictures in a book. And I could hardly wait the time that I would learn to talk. Yes, I remember many things from all the birthdays that I turned and how I grew since I was 3 or even 2 or 1. And I can also still recall my very, very first year of all, when I was very, very small. The year when I was none.
Oh, I got volunteered, huh?
Yeah, you got volunteered.
All right. Well, in that case, we'll start with one of my favorites. This is based on a true story. After I got out of the Navy, I went to school in Wyoming. I went to a little college in Sheridan, Wyoming. I was an ag major specializing in equine studies. And one of the neat places in town is the old Sheridan Inn, which is on the list of National Historic Places. Got a big, huge sign out front that says, you know, Historic Sheridan Inn. Used to be a hotel. It's now a museum. And what made it famous was the fact that Buffalo Bill used to sit on a rocker on the back porch and hold auditions for his Wild West show. Now, the neat thing is that the bar is still there, still operates. Great place to go on a Friday or Saturday night to do some dancing and have some fun. And I came across this instance one February, and it just struck me as being really kind of amusing, so I wrote this poem. It's called The Fence Riders. One Friday night in midwinter with snow piled to 6 feet, I thought I'd go out on the town for drinks and friends to meet. The lot was packed outside the bar and the parking space was tight. But as I stopped to seek a spot, I witnessed a strange sight. Tied to the sign outside the bar and blowing clouds of steam, 2 ponies standing side by side. It wasn't just a dream. Why they were there, I didn't know. It was something I'd not seen. Two cowboys had stopped by, I guess, to spend a little green. The crowded bar was full of cheers as I came through the door. There were so many people there, you couldn't see the floor. But as I pushed through towards the bar, my mind on a stiff drink, I didn't see the strange tableau until I reached the brink. Two cowboys that were standing there, each with a drink in hand, a tapping toes and talking soft while listening to the band. But all around for quiet space, the crowd was kept at bay. It made no sense at all, you see, that they were moved away. These cowboys seemed to pose no threat. They weren't crude or rude, and certainly there was no sign they'd bullied some poor dude. But as I crossed the open space, it all became quite clear why no one in that crowded bar had even dared come near. It seems that these two cowboys had been riding fence a spell, that they'd not bathed in many weeks, I easily could tell. 'Twas whiskey first and then a bath, these two had been a-thinking as they were riding to the ranch, both tired and a-stinking. 'Twas because they'd seen the lights, they'd stopped at that bar first and tied their ponies to the side so they could quench their thirst. But after they had drunk their fill, they ambled back outside to mount their ponies and ride off, the smiles from all quite wide. So if you see some ponies tied near where you park your car, just mingle with the crowd inside and steer clear of the bar. Yeah, so besides doing poetry, I also tell stories in my performances. And since we're on that subject of Sheridan, Wyoming, and me going to school out there, while I was there, I got a job at a ranch to learn more about the horses and things that I needed to do for the college. And of course, being the new man in the group, it befell to me to do all of the really yucky jobs, like cleaning out stalls and digging post holes and stuff like that. Now, most of the places that we could get to on the ranch, we had a tractor with a big post hole pounder, and you could just drive up, pound the post in, and tie the wire on, and we're done. But there were a few places where there wasn't a place where you could get that tractor into, so you had to do it the old-fashioned way. Dig them by hand. So the boss came to me one day and said, I need you to go out there, and here's a post hole digger, go for it, and, you know, let me know how you do it. Well, I got out there, and I guess I got a little too enthusiastic, and this was an old post hole digger, and next thing I know, I broke the handle off. So I came back to the ranch, and sorry, you know, it broke. I said, well, don't worry about it, we'll get you another one. So the next day I go in, and he hands me this brand spanking new post hole digger. And he says, here, this was yours, you earned it. And my first thought was, wow, I came out here to go to school. I've been here only 6 months, and I've already earned my first PhD. Thank you. While I was starting to do the cowboy poetry, I was talking to Ingrid about doing this stuff, and she goes, well, if you're going to do cowboy poetry, you got to do something with thunder and lightning in it. So I thought about that, and I sat down, and I wrote this poem in about 15 minutes. It just, boom, all of a sudden, everything came all at once. So this is called Thunder on the Mesa. The mesa stood in stark relief against the lowering sky. The cattle seemed more restless as we drove them slowly by. It had been nearly 40 days since we'd had any rain, so we were moving the whole herd to Soda Springs again. But on this drive, our fifth this year to get these cows to water, an unexpected front moved in and rain began to spatter. Now this part of West New Mexico had bone dry through July, as near as I remember things since I was a little guy. So these black clouds a-piling up against the mesa tall gave plenty cause for worry as we sang our cattle call. When pushing plus 200 head through desert canyons wide, the clicking sound of cattle horns gives goosebumps to your hide. And when more than 800 hooves are added to the din, I have no need to tell you of the fix that we were in. 'Cause all this noise makes cattle spook and jump that rocks the clatter. Their eyes grow bigger with each step. Their fright's no laughing matter. So when the rain came pelting down and lightning flashed above us, the herd took off in a stampede as if hell-bent for Texas. And then there came a mighty crash as thunder followed lightning. Off both sides of the canyon walls, the sound was truly frightening. And then again the lightning flashed with peals of rolling thunder. Sam and his pinto had no chance as they were swept asunder. For now the herd was running hard with no space left to turn. And Jack was racing for his life, and Arroyo's what saved him. His pony jumped the 20 feet to cross the raging water. The cattle just ran into it like little lambs to slaughter. And suddenly as it began, that summer storm was over. The sun came out and all was still, which helped this shaken drover. That timely flash flood checked the herd. We only lost a handful. And poor old Sam, crushed by the hooves, the sight was something awful. We buried Sam and the pinto horse at the base of that big mesa. I carved his name on a big red rock and quoted a line from Isaiah. And you never know when punching cows what Mother Nature's up to. She'll make you smile. She'll whip you off. That's a cowboy's life. It'll do.
Never done a poetry reading before. My line of work is working with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, and I had a conversation with an old friend on Facebook, and I had no idea that she grew up in as a battered child, and she told me about a dream she had, and so I decided to write something about her dream. It's called Mishi's Dream. When I was little, I used to dream about an abusive person in my life. He once caused me to fall out of an airplane, and all sorts of bad outcomes in my dreams. In real life, I did not run, did not fight. I just froze, and I took it. Haven't had a dream about him in 30 plus years now. Last night, he was calling my name. In real life, I went to him as quickly as possible. The beating would be worse the longer it took me to get to him. Last night, I did not run away. I did not answer. I did not run to him. I just listened, no longer afraid.
So April is the month that Poem of the Year Pocket Day falls in. And a few years ago, actually it was 2009, my sister, she teaches flute in Anchorage, Alaska. She has a flute choir and she works with kids in the school with their instruments. And she said that she wanted to do a poetry contest where the prize would be a piccolo that would inspire her flute kids to take part in the Poem in Your Pocket Day event. So this was written, it's called A Piccolo in Their Pocket. It was written for the Arctic Wind Flute Choir, Junior Flute Choir, and Preparatory Flute Choir, and other flute students of Barbara Eberhardt of the Alaska Flute Study Center on Poem in Your Pocket Day, April 30th, 2009. In the wintry Northland is a lost tribe of players led by a dashing picara, a piccolo playing picara. Perhaps to appease the wind spirits, each autumn parents bring the picara young children, their nervous and trembling children. Only those who meet her gaze bravely are then taken in to join the singular tribe, flute players of the wintry Northland. For years, the young flute players work. They fillet skin from their fingers, practicing scales, progressions, tunes, and trills. They sweat over the tiniest details of how to stand, how to sit, how to breathe, how to eat, how to dress, how to write a thank you letter, all the while becoming a bright, tight ensemble with camaraderie seldom seen in ones who are still in their teens. But the tribe is a fluid composition, and change is always the constant. When breakup comes to the Northland, it is time for the oldest to leave. The Picara sends them away, she hopes, well prepared, with nothing so cliché as a song in their heart, but with something few others can boast. Arctic wind players of a land so glorious, the Picara's Northland tribe, notorious, carry the right, nay, the privilege, to carry a piccolo in their pocket. In the wintry Northland is a lost tribe of players, led by a dashing Picara, a piccolo playing Picara. I live out towards Blockhouse, and I've got a couple hoser dogs that I walk every day. If I don't, they go crazy. Kathy knows this. She's had
some. I'm a witness.
Yes. Yes, Queenie especially. This is called A Walk in the Country. The substitute driver for the senior bus takes the long way to pick up Mrs. Butler. A rookie raven carries off a golf ball from the field. Dew catcher cobwebs on the snowberry bushes. The fellow with the two Shelties has moved away. Old Tom's buddy died last year. I am the only one who still walks this stretch with dogs. The cows watch as we pass. Mount Adams is flagging, Mount Hood lost in fog. The county grader goes up and down East Winterstein. Bateman brought hay to his herd last night. He did not notice the cow with ear tag number one had porcupine quills in her forehead. I'm kind of going through some of my old stuff. This was one that I wrote when we lived in the Tri-Cities, probably in the 1980s, a long time ago. It's called No Bones About It. Georgia O'Keeffe is not my hero, though I love the enigma of Stieglitz nudes, and I have her fascination, for I gather bones about me of small dead things. I've tucked away a mouse skull in a 5-cent plastic tube where two sharp and cracked incisors catch on cotton swabs. Cow bones are the bulk of my collection, carried home from riding on the range. I examined them well, but the one I watch most carefully is all but the lower jaw of what was a local coyote pup, 19.5 centimeters from end of the cranium to beginning of the nose. Beetles have burrowed into its respiratory maze. It smells of old rooms and dark holes. I wonder about the 22 bore left of center between the eyes. This is also an old piece. Grandfather came from a huge family, and we always had great aunts and great uncles that would come and visit us when we were kids. One of my most amazing uncles was Henry. He got his mining degree from University of Idaho, and then he went up to Alaska and traveled around all over the place doing about everything imaginable. And when I knew him, he was probably in his 80s. He was a small guy, but he always seemed bigger than he really was. And he had glasses that were about pop bottle thick. And he was a very impressive fellow. This is called Great Uncle Henry's Dinner Time Rhyme. Let's see. Mom was making soup because the window in the kitchen was steamed up. And I remember smelling onion when I walked in the door. It was late in the fall, not quite winter. Daylight savings had just changed, and we had come home in the dark. I must have had something to do after school, because I caught a ride with Dad. That was when he still drove the yellow Mustang. I don't think he had it very long after that. The aunties, Carl and Uncle Henry, had been over that weekend, and Henry had stayed when the others went back to Seattle. I think it was about the last time he visited us. His eyesight wasn't good, and the thick glasses he wore looked too heavy for someone so old. He was a slight little man, shorter than me, but he never seemed fragile or helpless. One thing about Uncle Henry, he could look after himself, whether he was searching for lost temples in the jungles of Thailand, meeting the pickled ancestors of Borneo tribesmen, or looking for the best price of a haircut in downtown Rio de Janeiro. Besides well-traveled, Uncle Henry was an educated man. He had a degree in mining engineering and a classical education as well. At least it seemed so to me. There he stood, in the warmth by the stove, the center of attention as Mom worked to make dinner around him. The question he asked was, what did you learn in school today? The answers he received were far from impressive. It had been the usual stuff, nothing great like the rhyme of the ancient mariner, you know, the long poem about the guy who shot the albatross and wore it around his neck. Uncle Henry knew the entire epic. He had learned it as a boy, and he hadn't forgotten a word. Believe me, I was impressed. There he stood, from first stanza to last, gesturing, exclaiming, lamenting the fate of that doomed sea captain. And while he recited, raising the specter of strange sailing ships tossed about or drifting becalmed and helpless in the midst of the lost seas of legend, the soup in the big open canning kettle on the stove bubbled and boiled its contents in a hot, wild tempest of its own. A couple more. This is called Sisters. You got them? You know what it's all about. Sisters. She has no business having that young horse. I heard secondhand from one who was there, quite judgmental, according to my source, 7 years my junior, rushing to share. Silly, middle-aged women firmly caught in the reticulum of childhood's lair. Kindness, care, and compassion we were taught when each of us was just a little girl. They stiffened the stuff from which we were wrought and served us well in our everyday world. But towards sisters, we can still be mean in the guise of concern, stinging barbs hurled, slung without foresight, yet the aim is keen. Am I guilty too, or my conscience clean? If anybody else has anything further, we definitely have the time and the place here.
Well, I wouldn't mind sharing a poem about our sister. Let's see.
My husband was in the Navy, and we were stationed in Florida for a while, and when I was expecting our first baby, my sister, who was in high school at the time, came to spend a year with me to help me while I was having this first baby. And it was complete culture shock for her to go from San Francisco to Florida. I will share with you why that was so. This is called The Catalyst. She adored her older sister, and she came to spend a year when her sister was expecting her first child. And her mother thought the change from California to the South might be good because
This teen was pretty wild. Sister's husband in the Navy would be gone for 8 long months and was loath to leave his pregnant wife alone. So the offer of her sister to become his wife's companion was to him more peace of mind than he had known. So Patricia came to Stanford, gave up being an avid groupie for such bands as Herman's Hermits and The Who, or her special love, Mark Lindsay, of Paul Revere and the Raiders. Left her friends to help her sister make it through. 'Twas her junior year in high school. It was 1967. Florida was in the segregated South. For a girl with a liberal outlook from race-tolerant San Francisco, culture shock just had her gaping open-mouthed. From the signs that said, whites only, to the terse, no blacks allowed, to the buses where the blacks rode in the back, also segregated diners where no blacks and whites would mingle. In the schoolrooms, too, teachers were keeping track. And it bothered her immensely because her parents always taught her that a person's value wasn't in his skin. And she chafed at all the rules that sought to keep from forming friendships with those niggers from the classes she was in. And they rode the self-same buses, both the white and colored students, but the blacks were relegated to the back. And she bristled when the driver yelled at her to sit up front, because a white girl don't belong there with them blacks. So at 16, she felt torn between the values of her family and the school district authority as expressed by an obstinate bus driver who enforced this segregation, until finally she felt beyond oppressed. Was this not the land of freedom, where her parents immigrated to escape the bands of Europe and its strife? Opportunity for all had been the overriding motto for the millions who dreamt of a better life. Was she now to be denied even the basic want of friendship? Should this ideology keep black and white apart? For in all she had been taught about the worth of any human, she knew segregation to be wrong at heart. So one day she was decided that she would no longer hearken to commands, but would try another tack. As she stepped aboard the school bus, said a greeting to the driver, she proceeded to sit down clear in the back. The black students nudged each other, but her girlfriends just smiled broadly as she settled in among them in the rear. Then the driver scanned his mirror and he noticed that white face, that to him she didn't belong there, was quite clear. Sit up front, he soon commanded, but she countered, I don't want to. I would like to enjoy the company of my friends. Sit up front where you belong, miss, for I won't begin this bus route till you move your white behind and make amends. Sorry, sir, I plan to stay here, for I think the rule is silly that forbids me sitting with a friend who's black. So you might as well start driving, for you see, I'm quite determined. I'll be staying with my friends here in the back. And the driver fumed and sputtered and refused to drive the bus, said he'd segregate if it took him all night. But Patricia wouldn't budge. And other students held their breath. And Patricia kept insisting she was right. An amazing thing occurred then, as the kids, one after another, left their seats, despite the driver's verbal flack, some whites back and some blacks forward, as students moved to claim their friendships. They all realized there was no going back. The bus driver cursed and threatened and refused to start the engine. He would sit all night if that is what it took. But the students kept their new seats in their mild, respectful protest till the driver was so angry that he shook. At last, the furious bus driver saw he clearly was outnumbered. At the moment, his authority was gone. So he grudgingly drove homeward. But the students had established integration on the bus from that point on. And the catalyst? Patricia was the one. Anything else? This is another one.
I like people. I like playing with words and word meanings. And I wrote this just because I wanted a whole different base of expressing, talking, communication. It's called The Mountain Speaks. She whispers scents of dewy grass. She breathes perfume of sage and pine. She burbles streams among the rocks and prattles cataracts downline. She sighs of mighty oaks and firs conferring in their lofty halls. She roars throughout her craggy peaks and thunders mighty waterfalls. The mountain speaks. She blurts cascading swarms of rocks. She shouts of boulders crashing force. She screams the echo of the hawk and howls the blizzard's swirling course. She laughs in sparkling, lapping tarns. She sings in ageless melodies. She cries the crispness of the morning, groans in ancient agonies. The mountain speaks. She scolds the traveler at her peak who underestimates her might, and then laments his fragile life as she observes his final plight. And gently she will bid him sleep. She'll mourn in still solemnity, with murmurs yet of life renewed, and whispers of eternity. The mountain speaks.
One more, we're done, and there's nothing else to do. This is called Inchoate Virtue. It's inchoate is kind of the chaos where all things grow out of. Mm-hmm. Virtue, well, let's see, a collection of small objects, say picking up shells on a beach. In this shoebox, my fingers dip and sift through pebbles, petrified wood and fossil shells, agates, sunstone, and obsidian chips, where temporal ages are encrypt, fine virtue, this pocket detritus with more bits added, piece by piece by piece.
Well, there's tons of cookies, there's more coffee and juice if you want to help yourself.
Okay. All right.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is delightful.
Yeah. That's what it's been.